curtain has descended across the country.
Today, our very freedom came under attack.
If young people do not see hope, what kind of message are we sending?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the podcast. My name is Colin McEwen, and we are about to do something completely different. I promised last week that this week we'd have the Consul General of Greece. I lied. Sorry. That'll be on Thursday, actually, if we're going to have a bonus episode, making for a total of two this week. And then after that, we'll be back to our normal Tuesday episodes. As you may have noticed, it's just me today, and it'll just be me on Thursday, too, since, as you might expect, you know, the consulate wants privacy and security protocols, all of that, so I couldn't record there. What are we doing this week? Well, the team of interns here at the NATO Association of Canada went on a field trip of sorts last Wednesday to the Canadian Forces College, and I think it's worth sharing, as a part of Canada that almost never sees the light of day, really. The students we saw that day were nearing the end of a course called Joint Command and Staff Program. The syllabus for that is actually publicly available. I've linked it in the episode description on the website, although it's 68 pages of boring technical descriptions, really. Essentially, all the people taking that course are already enlisted officers in the Canadian Armed Forces. Most of them were majors, a few lieutenant colonels. This is basically a necessary step in their professional development if they ever want to advance further in the ranks to, say, a colonel or a brigadier general. If you're not familiar with army ranks and, you know, how important those are, there isn't actually a standardized number in Canada of how many troops are commanded by a major. A major leads a unit called a company. Four companies make a battalion, and a battalion is generally between 1 and 200 soldiers in Canada. I mean, it's not very exact, but it gives you a rough idea of what they're doing. Anyway, they were nearing the end of their course, so we were able to witness them carrying out basically a war game. They'd spent weeks preparing for this scenario. They had an elaborate course of action, or COA as they call it, the first of what seemed to be at least 150 acronyms that we heard that day. Anyone who's ever played, you know, Risk, or Axis and Allies, or the fancy Game of Thrones board game has maybe some idea of how this works. You're actually wrong. You have no idea how this works. The faculty overseeing this war game claimed that it actually glossed over, you know, some of the tactical details, but this was several orders of magnitude more complex than anything you can imagine without having seen it before. Nothing is left to chance. No dice were used. Both sides had every significant factor planned out. There was a referee to decide in case of, you know, conflicts between what they were doing, but there's no luck. The person directing naval action on their team, for example, could spend a full 10 minutes talking about what they were doing, and that's even with a generous use of acronyms to condense their jargon. You'd hear something like, RCVBG will move into the JOA looking for HVTs with RTLAMs, particularly, you know, CNC nodes with a view to IA. And you're sitting on the sidelines thinking, wait, hold on, what did he just say? So, having learned some of these acronyms by the end of the day, I can actually unpack this sentence for you. So let's see, our carrier battle group, which is it's a formation of ships centered around an aircraft carrier, that's CVBG, will move into the JOA, the Joint Operational Area, the place where ships from several different countries are doing stuff, looking for HVTs, high-valued targets, which I hope is self-explanatory, with our TLAMs, Tomahawk Land Attack Missiles, it's a cruise missile, particularly CNC nodes, command and control nodes, so that could be, you know, communications, places where officers are to, you know, disrupt the chain of command, with a view to IA, influence activities, which is a broad category, but it covers like public relations, media strategies, all that sort of things. It looks good to your audience, to your public, if you're able to say we're taking out, you know, lots of their leaders sort of thing. Now, when you add up all of this, if you have a scenario that's even moderately plausible compared to real life, it's pretty easy to see how this sort of planning exercise can be used as a culminating activity in military education. They had their, you know, their exams the very next day, sort of thing. Actually, I should note that most of these people in the course were reservist officers. That is to say, they were not part of the regular force. Reservists are... There are a number of differences between these. I'll try and explain them, which is part of what this episode is about. Reservists, perhaps most significantly, cannot be forced to deploy overseas, unlike regular troops. Reservists have to volunteer for overseas service, except in cases of severe national emergency, but something of that scale is, we're talking about like World War II. Nothing that big has happened since. These are also not full-time soldiers we're talking about. Quite the opposite, in fact. How much service is required of them varies between units and between branches. There are, you know, Army Reservists, Naval Reservists, Air Force Reservists, Medical Reservists, actually. How much service is required of them will vary between all of these. Rule of thumb, which one of them mentioned, could be something like, you know, one night a week, one weekend a month. Which doesn't sound too bad, although consider that many of these people actually already have full-time jobs, and in fact, many of them have full-time jobs that are quite demanding. And so to leave that to go for reservist duty or training, even if it's just a ceremony, it's maybe not as stressful, but it's certainly not a break from what they were doing before. I could easily see how it could be, you know, exhausting. And if that wasn't enough, a lot of companies composed of, you know, civilians don't necessarily grasp all of this, and so when someone asks for 3 weeks off to go do their summer training, which they have to do every year, you know, they've got to stay on top of their skills, then they may end up having to take that out of their vacation time. And so when they come back, they're already kind of tired from having done just, you know, 3 weeks of military training. And this isn't just an excuse, an excuse sort of training either. They're, every reservist is trained to the level of a soldier in the regular service. The whole point is that they're supposed to be interchangeable, that a reservist who volunteers for overseas duty can take the place and carry out all the duties of a soldier in the regular force. And many of them, of course, have done this, whether from patriotic duty or whatever reason. Many reservists have been deployed overseas, have served, you know, honorably. Some have lost their lives in the service. Some of the students we talked to while we were there, actually, were reservists who had volunteered to deploy overseas and were coming back to further their professional career. And, of course, it's possible to transition from the regular force down to the reservist if they decide that... after a tour of duty overseas, or just after a set number of years, that full-time duty is not the best thing for them personally. But what they get from this is a series of skills that are difficult to replicate when you're training someone in a civilian context. Leadership comes to mind as the obvious one. Every soldier is trained how to lead, and every officer is also trained how to follow. These two things go hand in hand very much. But also a degree of teamwork that is also, I might say, unrivaled by anything really in the civilian world. Discipline, self-reliance. I mean, you could debate the merits of someone taking up this sort of training versus having additional education from, you know, a trade school or a university or what have you. It's a little tricky to compare, but the data from Israel, which famously requires service of a similar caliber from all of its citizens, suggests that there is some positive effect upon the economy more broadly, having large numbers of people that are trained with these sorts of skills. Another thing that might be surprising was the international component. It wasn't just Canadian officers in training that we saw there. There were representatives from the American Navy, the American Air Force, I believe, from New Zealand, from Jamaica, from Trinidad and Tobago, plenty of countries, NATO or not, that are allied with Canada in some way or another. Which is actually a heartening step, if you think about it, that our future military leaders are trained from the time they join to be working with allies from a wide array of countries. Even if they never end up personally working with them, the concept will help them with whatever they're doing. And of course, if they have to work in a coalition with countries for whatever military action, then they're already ready to do it. More of this sort of thing was, I think, part of what our previous guest, Tim Hewish, had in mind for his, you know, Commonwealth Defense Cooperation. But this could also apply to, I mean, all sorts of countries. When you have your military officers trained and educated to work together, to expect that they'll be in the same operational zone, has benefits which carry out, obviously, when they're deployed, but also in cooperating with organization or sharing best practices, and so on. Enabling more of this is why we were there in the first place, actually. Another group was there, composed mostly of business executives, who were brought together by the Canadian Forces Liaison Council to inform them of what the reserves do, and to promote awareness that, you know, they too need their time to do things. And at the end, when their service returns, what they come back as is not just a trained soldier, but also a much better employee, and that they shouldn't have to use their vacation time for this, and so on. And what the CAFLC normally does is interventions is, I suppose you can call them interventions, with employers who are reluctant to do this, to try and not force them, but collaborate with them that this is actually a good idea. Now, this isn't to say that there is no danger at all. I mean, obviously, if you volunteer for overseas service, you're putting yourself in danger. And training accidents do happen. But the people who sign up for this fully grasp that our security in Canada is a foundation for almost everything else that happens in this country. And they've chosen to volunteer their time and efforts to help support this in one of the most direct manners that there is. Thanks for tuning in. Check out our website, natocouncil.ca, for previous episodes, as well as coverage of ongoing events every single day. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn, all of which can be found from our homepage. On Thursday, I promise this time, we're going to have the Consul General of Greece. Well, I say we're going to have, I'll be talking about it. So stay tuned for our special bonus episode. Talk to a diplomat, signing off.